Thank you very much, Dennis. And I'm just going to ask our panelists to come and take their positions now while I kind of get this session kicked off. And first by saying good morning to everybody. And so glad that you're all here and made this journey to help us all have these engaged conversations about, in this session one, the current and future competencies that are going to be required of all pharmacy practitioners. This is our first of two expert panel discussions that we're going to have, and I'll let our panelists come forward. As Dennis mentioned, my name is Victoria Roche, and I am the newest AACP appointee to the ACP Board of ACPE Board of Directors. And as my panelists get seated, I'm delighted to be able to introduce them to you. The bio sketches are available in your notebook along with the papers that they've written, and they're going to comment on briefly here today. But let me introduce them to my left, and this is the order they'll be speaking to us. Carmen Catazon, Executive Director, National Association of Boards of Pharmacy. Next to Carmen is Stephen Gray, Pharmacy Professional Affairs Leader for Kaiser Permanente in California. Then we have Nimesh Javeri, the Executive Director of Pharmacy Services from Walgreens. Tom Menigan, Executive Vice President and CEO for the American Pharmacists Association. Followed by Dan Robinson, Dean of Western University for Health Sciences College of Pharmacy. And then finally, Lori Golterman, Clinical Specialist and National Director of Residency Programs and Pharmacy Benefits Management for Veterans Health Administration. Again, each of our panelists have written a paper reflecting their thoughts and views on the current and future competencies required of pharmacists, and those complete papers are in your notebook. But what we're going to do is ask each of them to kind of pull out or tease out what they feel are the most important or compelling points that they wanted to make about these critical elements, saving what we hope will be a good 40 minutes with luck for some engaged, facilitated discussion here, and then ultimately, later in the morning, some opportunity for the audience to ask them some questions as well. So I'm going to gently remind the panelists that we were asking them to speak no more than 10 minutes at the podium, and my seat is right here, so that gentle nudge on the side there, I'm positioned appropriately to give you that reminder. But without further ado, I know you're eager to hear from them, and I'd like to call to the podium Carmen Catazon. Carmen, I'll try to get your slide.
Thank you, Victoria. My thanks to ACP, to Peter and Bill for organizing this conference and providing the opportunity for NABP to participate. A special thanks to ACP staff that worked hard to make sure our presentations were in and nudged us, and I apologize that the nudging took a lot more from my end, so I appreciate all of your efforts. Here with me today, if you have any additional comments or interaction, is the current chairman of the NABP Executive Committee, Malcolm Broussard, as well as the president of the NABP Executive Committee, Mike Burleson. Malcolm is also the executive director of the Louisiana Board of Pharmacy. Mike is executive director of the Kentucky Board of Pharmacy. And then Jeannie Wagoner, a member of the Texas Board of Pharmacy, is also a member of our executive committee. The focus of my remarks today will be to talk about competency, the standards, and input to the standards and the educational process from the state boards of pharmacy. And basically, there's two themes that represents: the legal requirements and a reality check. So in terms of what the state boards are responsible for and the input the state boards can provide, they legally define what the requirements are for licensure, which include the educational component, which include the ACP standards to a large degree, because of recognition of ACP and the standards. What's interesting is we're hoping that the input that Donna provided, and I'm trying to decide as one of the comments about flushing the toilet, if that's a half or a full push on the toilet. there's a lot of things in this hotel I've never experienced on the south side of Chicago, so. But we're hoping that as education embarks down the path and new standards are considered, we know that education needs to be ahead of practice. It needs to be ahead of even the NAPLEX examination and assessment. But we're hoping that it doesn't lose touch with reality. And the comments that Donna shared are the opinions that we believe are held by a lot of the practitioners and board members, and we hope those comments will be taken seriously, even though at times they're discounted because there's not the scholarly research and documentation to verify or validate those comments or opinions, but they are critically important. So as you consider residencies and consider the pharmacist being one of the primary objectives moving into primary care, we ask that we look at the reality checks that we're going to talk about, because in many instances, pharmacists aren't delivering the type of pharmacist care that we've been talking about and that the programs have been preparing pharmacists for a number of years. It all begins with a unified definition. We have that. It's in the practice acts. It's in the NAPLEX. Many people may not want to accept that or may not agree with that, but the definition of entry-level competence is defined by the boards and then illustrated, defined, and measured by the NAPLEX. As an interesting side note, we're working on a new tool for practitioners to assess the use of controlled substances, and when we bring it to the docs look at it, they look at the research we've done, and they say, great, and they implement it in their practice. So we have 22 hospitals and emergency rooms using this tool. When we bring it to pharmacists, they say, wait a minute, we've got to redefine everything and come up with our definitions, even though things are already defined in the literature and physicians are using them. So when it comes to the definitions, we hope that also we'll look at what's already been defined and some of the standards that the boards have said. The scope of the NAPLEX really is to decide the knowledge, skills, and abilities that's needed for entry-level competence or minimum competence. These are the components to go into that, and I want to talk about what we know, but I want to stop here for a moment to say I was pleased by the survey results regarding the NAPLEX that said the NAPLEX doesn't measure the full breadth of pharmacy education, pharmacy program. That's exactly where the NAPLEX should be. We have practice that's probably at this level. We have the NAPLEX that's here, and we have education that's above there. NAPLEX tries to pull those two components to a medium point that the boards have defined that's a subset of total pharmacy education that says these are the components that are absolutely necessary for the boards of pharmacy to say that this individual can safely and effectively practice pharmacy to meet their legal responsibility. The NAPLEX is not designed to measure the whole scope of education, and it's not designed to measure some of the other components that are part of the curriculum that are changing. So we need to just keep that in mind and then look at how we can revise the NAPLEX to stay in touch with education, but at the same time let people know that NAPLEX is a reality check. And reality check comes from the survey. And when we did a survey of practitioners across the country, we found that there wasn't much change from the last time we conducted the survey and what people were doing, what people thought were important, and what was critical to protecting the public health. So again, we say that the NAPLEX is that reality check, and the data that we have, we hope that you'll use so that you can evaluate how far education needs to go and how far our practitioners have gone, so that we just don't talk to ourselves and think we're doing all these great things and see these isolated best practices, but have to recognize, as Donna said, it's not happening across the country, and we don't want the gap between where the educational programs are going, where the NAPLEX is, and where practice really is to be too large. In closing, some of the items that are coming up, prescription drug abuse, disciplinary actions, and then our assessment of reentry. I looked at some of the survey results, and I think Donna touched on this as well, where people said that students and new practitioners were prepared to deal with prescription drug abuse and other topics. The reality and logic are saying different. Prescription drug abuse is one of the most serious issues facing the United States. In many states, it kills more patients and more people than auto accidents and heart attacks. Somewhere, the pharmacist is in that process. We know it begins with the doc, but there are pharmacists that aren't prepared to make those decisions and aren't making those decisions, and we're seeing those results and those data in the emergency rooms and in the morgues and in everyday life based upon prescription drug use. We have to look at those realities and work it in. We've been asked by one of the federal agencies, one of the offices of the Inspector General, to look at disciplinary actions to see if there's any trends. Are there certain states, are there certain programs, colleges or schools of pharmacy, where we see repeat disciplinary actions? And if there are, what's the problem there? Or what's an hypothesis for why certain students from certain programs or practitioners from certain states encounter the same types of disciplinary actions? And then we're looking at how do we prepare another assessment, which we have that's available, for pharmacists reentering practice. If there's a question of competence, or perhaps the board wants to make sure that they've stayed up to date. So we're trying to build that continuum between the NAPLEX, the PCOA, the Pharmacist Curriculum Outcome Assessment, and now the PEAR, to give a continuum of data for people to utilize in building curriculums, building standards, and making licensure decisions. So thank you very much.
Thanks. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. I remember one of my recent trips to Georgia. I had an experience which I still remember very vividly, and that is traveling between here and Savannah. And many of you may know that between here and Savannah is a lovely little town called Macon, Georgia. And there's some lovely bed and breakfast there. I encourage you to go there. But I bring that up because recently Macon, Georgia was in the news because its school district has made a very interesting decision. They have decided that every student in Macon, Georgia, from pre-kindergarten on up, that is state-run school, shall learn Chinese. Every student, elementary, high school, etc., shall learn Chinese. Now, this is an area that is primarily agricultural, where the largest growing and fastest growing ethnic group is Spanish, and yet they've chosen to learn Chinese. And when challenged on that decision, the administrator said, "We have an ethical obligation to teach students for the world they will live in, not the world we live in." And he's talking about starting with first, second, third graders and looking ahead to when the world is populated with maybe 1.5 billion people who speak Mandarin, where the largest economy in the world is that population. And these are what he sees, the students who many of them, maybe most of them, will leave Macon, Georgia and have to live and thrive in that world. And I comment on that because that's the way I look at the education of pharmacists. We heard last night a great presentation on some visions about where the practice of pharmacy is going. And I've had the wonderful experience, I believe, in saying that that world, that ACO world, that integrated care organization world, is today. It's not tomorrow. And so beginning now, and as that proliferates, we need to be sure that we're preparing our pharmacists for a world that is free of the fee-for-service problem, that is part of a team of true healthcare professionals, and that these pharmacists come out with a PharmD degree in order to thrive in that world and be a very meaningful, if not stellar, asset to society because of that education. Last night it emphasized teamwork. I don't have a slide set here. There's no way I could put all my thoughts in a few slides. I have given you a paper. I thank all of you that took the time to read that. You know, as a lawyer, I tend to do two things. One, be overly verbose, so please keep me on time. And second, I learned very early on from my professors that a good lawyer always gets it in writing but never puts it in writing. So with that in mind, I don't have a PowerPoint. But I'd like to talk about a couple of things that I did emphasize. I attend virtually every Board of Pharmacy meeting in California, and that includes the subcommittee meetings where you can actually have a discussion. The formal board meetings, as many of you know, tend to be a play where things play out according to a previously designed script. Their strategic planning meeting, I'm usually the only public member in the audience. And then California law, they sit around in a circle and they talk for hours and then they turn around and they say, "Well, let's hear from the public," and I'm the only one there usually. So I tend to get a lot of insight. And a couple of things have, we comment on that experience, my experience in the ICO, and then my talks across the country. One of the things I emphasized was that when you have a law that gives a person the privilege of practicing pharmacy and a license, then that license is very broad. It allows them to do a lot of things. And I tend to disagree with those who say that, well, we start with a survey of what people are actually doing, and then we examine what they're actually doing to develop the test, and then we go on from there to develop a curriculum. I think you have to start with a concept of what does that law allow them to do, and then let's make sure to protect the public by making sure that they are at least competent enough to know what they do not know. Competent enough to know what they do not know. And the reality of that is, a good example that I had in my paper was the tragedy we had in California about sterile compounding, where the schools had virtually at that time abandoned compounding and abandoned sterile compounding. Consequently, they said, you'll get that when you go on your IPPE or your APPE. And by the way, we've got this alumni, and he's really good at that. Go out and take a rotation with them if you want to do sterile compounding. That decision was based on basically the training that the school did not give to that alumni. The tragedy was that in a shortage situation, they compounded a sterile product. Many of you heard about it. 11 people were hospitalized. 3 patients died. And there was a fourth death. The fourth death was the suicide of the junior partner of that alumni. So here's a situation where not really understanding the chemistry, the fundamental chemistry of sterilization of a non-sterile basic ingredients led to someone make a terrible, tragic mistake, which then led to a political solution. The senator from that district said, I've got to have a political solution to keep my job. We now have a sterile compounding as a separate license for pharmacies in California. And my concern is, keeping that in mind, that when we grant a license, it's a very broad license to do things. We got to make sure that the schools teach them. How do they do that? There's so much to do. My belief is that for pharmacy education, we need to take a look at a couple of things. Are we asking the pharmacy schools to do too much? Should ACPE, should the standards be such that they really talk more about what you have to come to pharmacy school with? Things that aren't the traditional practice, or excuse me, the traditional curriculum. Should we push things into the pre-pharmacy curriculum such as skills and knowledges that will develop leaders? You know, when I look at leadership and I look at associations and so forth and what they taught me in leadership and my experiences, these were things I did not get in pharmacy school. Project management. Project management. You get to be a leader because someone identifies you to do a project. And if you do good, you get a bigger project. And if you do good, you get a bigger project. And the next thing you know, you're running a major organization. You know, and I can think of some leaders in California that are now CEOs, pharmacists who are CEOs of ACOs. And those ACOs are going to use pharmacists to their full capability. I'm very confident. The other thing you don't get, and what's very important, is negotiation. How do you do project management? How do you practice pharmacy in an integrated care organization without negotiation skills? You know, in our diverse culture, one of the things I find is that the foreign-born students, or the first generation, are very skilled in negotiation because they come from countries where negotiation happens every day for your daily meals. But that skill is pretty much lost in our culture. And so our students don't even know what they don't even know about how to do negotiations, and that is a vital part of their life and their cult and their profession for the rest of their lives. And lastly, is ethics. You know, I continually hear all the time that, well, there's business ethics, or there's personal ethics, or there's professional ethics. And I teach law and ethics at one of the California schools, and I'm here to tell you, there's only one ethics. It's just ethics. And we don't separate those. And if we do keep separating those, and that's who continually gets in trouble with the Board of Pharmacy, people who don't have a fundamental ethical foundation. And that's why the Board of Pharmacy and others have said ethics have to be a mandatory course. And in California, they've made it one of the conditions of probation. When your license is put on probation, you have to attend an accredited ethics course at one of the schools. So those things that are fundamental to a career need to be pushed, and other things, into pre-pharmacy. The second thing is that in order to teach more in pharmacy school, and I mean teach, I'm not just lecture, but actually teach, I'm concerned about class size. You know, if we have an interaction and we're supposed to make a connection with students, how do you do that with 200 or plus students, or 120, or even 80? The course I teach is with 60 students, and I can tell you that to give them a good experience in law and ethics, that's too many probably. So we either have to do that. So my thoughts are that in general, that we need to move some things out of the traditional curriculum, make it more intense. Maybe three-year schools are no longer acceptable, and maybe working during pharmacy school, you don't work during medical school or law school. Is it reasonable to expect people to hold down a job and go to pharmacy school at the same time? Thank you for your attention.
Well, good morning. So I'll get all of the short jokes out of the way. I am standing. I don't need a podium. And it's a pleasure to be here. I want to thank the ACPE. It's an absolute honor to address this group. It's an honor for me to be even here with this esteemed group. So thank you very, very much. You know, what we're going to talk about, what I'm going to talk about is what we're doing in terms of actually executing on what you are all are creating. You know, one of the things that I want to make sure that from a Walgreens perspective that you all understand is ACPE is doing a heck of a job. Our education is doing a heck of a job. Can we improve it? Absolutely. But the challenge and the gap has always been, how do we execute what you are creating? And hopefully, in my 10 minutes, I can show you what Walgreens is doing to execute on that vision. I do want to thank a couple of folks. The model that I'm going to show you requires, depending on the state, 9 regulatory changes. So when you talk about barriers to advancing the profession of pharmacy and advancing healthcare, that is probably the number one thing standing in our way is constraints from the regulatory bodies. However, we tested this model in Illinois first, and then the first state out of Illinois, Illinois is our home state, so we have to test everything there, is we went to Indiana. And Donna's sitting right in the front row, and Donna sits on the board at Indiana Board of Pharmacy, and Donna and her colleagues actually helped us clear the pathway to test this concept in Indiana. Along with Donna Carmen from the NABP helped us and to push this along in other states. We right now have this model in several states, Indiana being our top state with almost 50 stores that operate in this model. But that number is the number one thing that we have to overcome if we're going to transform pharmacy. So Donna, Carmen, thank you very much for all of your help and your team's help to get us going. So what is this that I'm going to be talking about? It's called the Well Experience, and many of you have probably heard about it. Here's the goals of what we had. About 2 years ago, our company said, our profession is under attack. It's on its way out. There's technology that can replace us. There's technology that can do it better, faster, and cheaper than a pharmacist can. Here's the challenge. The Walgreens company has 27,000 pharmacists. Our CEO, president, and most of our management are pharmacists. We understand one thing, is that we have to do something to protect our profession. Walgreens, I'm sure you all realize we're practically on every corner. It's a great way to give directions. You know, take a right at the first Walgreens, take a left at the second Walgreens. Hey, I use it. But we're 75% of the U.S. population is within 5 miles of a Walgreens drugstore. 75%. 85% of all Hispanics and African Americans are within 5 miles of a Walgreens drugstore. We have access. The question for us is, how do we leverage that access in terms of healthcare? And that's what we try to do. So 2 years ago, we set out to do three things. Number one, to have pharmacy play a more integral role in the entire healthcare ecosystem. Number two, transform the profession of pharmacy. Not incrementally, but shifting it 180 degrees. We needed to do something to shock the system, because we can't continue on the path of incrementally improving. In 10 years, our profession will be gone. So we needed to do something to transform. And thirdly, is to create a patient experience and a customer experience that was unmatched. Those were the three goals that we had. And what we ended up doing was coming up with a simple statement. Our pharmacists dispense care, not product. And the more we focus on the product, the more we won't change. The more we not focus on the product, the greater our impact will be in the entire healthcare system. So here's what we did. We spent about 6 to 8 months speaking to several groups of folks. Number one, the patients. We actually spent time in patients' homes with them when they went to the physician, with them when they went to the pharmacy, with them when they ate dinner, with them when they took a shower. No, we didn't do that, so relax, that was a joke. No, but we actually spent time with them. We didn't do focus groups to say, okay, you know, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? About 10 minutes into the conversation of a focus group, they figure out who's paying them and they answer all the questions exactly how you want them to answer. We actually watched them, how they reacted. And then we had several insights that we took into consideration when we designed this. We worked with physician groups. We had a group of core physicians, nurses, nurse practitioners, pharmacists, and pharmacy technicians to help us understand what is it that we need to do to shift this team-based collaborative approach. And then we took all of those insights and designed what we think is one more step forward in transforming community pharmacy. So there was four goals of this entire blueprint. Number one, it had to be integrated. The entire store had to be integrated. The expectations of our patients and our customers doesn't start at the back of the house. It starts at the front of the house. So the concept of how do we keep you well, help you get, stay, and live well, has to start at the front door, not in the pharmacy. The pharmacy just simply encourages it and supports that concept. Number two, it has to be curated. So all the merchandising, the signage, what we say, the messaging, how our employees act, to all the way down to the uniform that they wear, has to be consistent. Number three, it has to be personal. It has to be about the patient and the consumer. We as an industry have continued to design products, systems revolving around us, not around them. A simple example is the concept of auto refill. Most of us have something called auto refill, right? We call the patient, we, you know, 72 hours before their prescription is ready to be refilled, we refill it automatically, and then we call them automatically through a system. You know, two, three, four times, and then the fourth time we basically tell the patient, hey, you know, if you don't pick this up, we're going to put it back in stock. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we simply tell the patient, your prescription is about to be finished. When would you like us to refill it? Text us back, call us, send us, touch a couple of buttons, and we'll take care of it from there on. That's doing it on their side. That's doing it for them. And then the last thing was it had to be collaborative. This is not about simply a pharmacy profession. This is about the entire healthcare ecosystem. And so what I'm going to show you, I have no PowerPoint slides. What I'm going to show you is actually a video of our first store. Dan Luce, Dan is in the audience, my colleague from Walgreens. Most of you know Dan. He's a lot better looking and articulate than me, so he's going to actually narrate the entire video. But here's the point, folks. At the end of the day, we could say all we want about what pharmacists should do, ought to do. But in the community setting, they continue to be bogged down by administrative tasks that they don't need to do. Handling phone calls that they don't need to be involved in. handling third-party adjudication and issues that they don't need to do. All of those things in this model have been centralized and taken out of the store. The phone doesn't ring. Heck, I'll go back to the store if the phone doesn't ring. And no third-party issues. Those are the types of things that we need to do to truly pull the pharmacist forward so they can practice pharmacy, not practice administrative tasks. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you this video. Take a look at it, and Dan's going to narrate it. So let me put this up here.
For decades, the pharmacy profession has been united in its desire to improve patient care by making pharmacists a more integral part of every patient's healthcare team. In addition to their special expertise in the risks and efficacy of medications, community pharmacists are readily accessible and convenient to most patients. But the profession has faced many challenges in achieving this goal, and for the most part, it has not been realized. Little progress has been made. Cost in various ways has been the greatest challenge. No approach, regardless of its merits, is likely to be adopted if it increases in any way the cost of healthcare. Walgreens has analyzed this issue in depth. We have learned, for example, that 37% of a typical pharmacist's time is spent doing tasks that can and should be performed by a pharmacy technician or cashier. Letting pharmacists be pharmacists again is the key. The way there is both simple and revolutionary. We need to rethink and reinvent the community pharmacy from square one. Introducing the new health experience pharmacy at Walgreens. This new kind of pharmacy is patient-centered, it's comfortable, professional, and inviting. It's fully interactive, more useful, providing products and services for prevention, management, well-being, and acute care. It's also high quality and safe. So how do we get there? We use a redesigned space, new tools, and new roles to offer Americans a path to better health by making healthy living an everyday experience. Here are some of the highlights. People are more likely to begin a health conversation in a warm, calm, professional environment. Seeing the frenetic production area isn't compatible with that. The best healthcare happens when a patient interacts with a pharmacist. So if we're going to move the profession forward, we have to move the pharmacist forward. Put the pharmacist where the patients are. The pharmacist must be able to provide new services and a higher level of care while still executing all of the traditional responsibilities of a pharmacist. Give the pharmacist new tools, training, and other support. The definition of pharmacy should be broadened to include a wide range of healthcare services, such as immunizations, health testing, education, medication therapy management, and acute care. Make healthy living an everyday experience. This is how patients and pharmacists will experience the reconceived pharmacy. The pharmacist will sit at a desk adjacent to the production area, easily seen and accessible to patients. The pharmacist will have easy physical access to the production area if needed by the pharmacy staff. Rather than being on a raised platform looking down at patients, the pharmacist will be at or below the patient's eye level. This makes patients feel more comfortable with approaching the pharmacist. Many administrative tasks, such as phone calls, data entry, and third-party billing, have been centralized to improve quality and keep the pharmacist patient-focused. The pharmacist will be able to supervise technicians utilizing numerous digital cameras that can be viewed and enlarged on their workstation monitor. The technicians will fill and process prescriptions in the production area using state-of-the-art digital imaging technology. The pharmacist, who remains patient accessible outside the production area, completes the final check of the filled prescription on screen using the images created by the technician in the filling process. The pharmacist will be in close proximity to a private consultation or health services room that is highly professional and comforting to patients. In trials of the new design, patients were 4 to 8 times more likely to speak to the pharmacist than they are in our current layout. The new environment is more comfortable and less stressful for both patients and pharmacists in order to foster a comfortable and low-stress interaction between them. One of the pharmacist's new tools is the Health Tablet, a consumer-facing device used to enhance consultations with personal profiles, medication guidance, health goal setting, and more. When appropriate, the pharmacist will be able to walk with the patient to the nearby guided merchandise aisle to advise the patient on over-the-counter medications, food supplements, and other health-related products. Other new features, such as our health guide, the Health Explorer, and rapid refill kiosks, will direct patients to the pharmacist for consultation when necessary. For decades, the pharmacy profession has talked about a new professional vision for community pharmacy, with less emphasis on filling prescriptions and more on providing health care. Today, Walgreens is doing something about it by taking the necessary steps to bring patients and their pharmacists closer together to improve each patient's medical outcomes and overall health. The evolution of pharmacy as envisioned by Walgreens will improve quality without increasing costs. It will also provide better, more effective health care, which should reduce readmissions and overall utilizations in the long run. These innovations are good for patients, good for the profession, and good for the overall healthcare system. The key to the future we all want is to let pharmacists be pharmacists again. That's the new health experience pharmacy at Walgreens.
And two other things that weren't on the video is, number one, there's a take care clinic attached in with nurse practitioners to this in close proximity to the pharmacist, as well as a health corner room for patient education. Anywhere from 6 to 10 people can sit in there. We work with local physicians and physician groups and non-for-profit organizations to conduct these types of sessions, so this becomes your one-stop healthcare solution. And that's what we're trying to do. So thank you very, very much.
Well, I do have a PowerPoint. Let's see here. I did escape. We'll do this. I'm exiting full screen. Exiting there. And we go to, where's play? There it is. Move your finger. There you go. Your finger has come up. Very good. Well, good morning, everyone. It's an honor and a pleasure for me to be here as well. I was counting, as I often do. I count stuff, and I counted that there are at least 15 current or former APHA board members or foundation board members or staffers in the room. So that's quite an audience, and it's an honor to be here, and it's an honor for all of them speaking on their behalf to be here and to participate in this incredibly important process. I don't envy the educators in the room today. Several of us commented last night about a story yesterday in USA Today about massive online courses being taught for free to anyone who wants them worldwide. It could radically change the way you do business, and I don't envy you as you grapple with that one, but it is also incredibly exciting. We're looking today in our organization at tremendous change in practice. There's an upheaval going on, if you hadn't noticed, around the move from buy low, sell high to services. We've sort of figured out that buy low, sell high isn't working particularly well anymore. As our margins have become more and more visible, they've become the target of poaching, and margins get smaller and smaller, and so our ability to provide the services that we would like to provide has gotten challenged and marginalized. Some folks, and it's, you know, Walgreens is certainly out there doing some pretty remarkable things, but they're not alone. There are a lot of other folks who are engaged in this kind of disruptive change, and we applaud that and are doing everything we can to support that. We spent a fair amount of time working with Clayton Christensen, had him as at an annual meeting a couple of years ago through the Community Pharmacy Foundation, got Clayton Christensen in as a speaker at an NCPO meeting last year, about 8-9 months ago, a gathering of all the execs of major national organizations, and got him to realize, Clay Christensen, the author of The Innovator's Prescription, that he missed it in that book, that there's a lot of disruption going on in healthcare, but that pharmacists and pharmacy has an opportunity to be the disruptor and to really change the game. He said that he sees a great future for pharmacists if they're willing to embrace disruptive change. And that means changes in technology and adoption of technology, changes in adopting value-added processes, and changes in building out networks. And those are incredibly important initiatives that you need to think about in your work in training new practitioners. In order for any disruptive change to be adopted broadly, it needs specificity, measurability, and predictability. And some of the speakers today have talked about those elements, but they are important. You can't have broad adoption of some pharmacy service if we can't describe it easily, if we can't be specific. You can't have broad adoption if nobody knows what it is that they're buying. That you can't measure it, that you can't say this is what you got for what you bought. And certainly you can't get broad adoption if a consumer can't go in to multiple places and predictably find that service. So those three things are key. Additionally, I would challenge you as you think about how you train new practitioners and you think about their need to be critical thinkers, is the need for them to be innovators, because they're going to have to change our world. They are the digital natives who have to change our world. And to do so, they need these skills: associating, questioning, observing, networking, and experimenting. These are the key skills that are built out in The Innovator's DNA, another book by Christensen, that describes trainable, learnable skills that anybody can pick up if they focus on them. We've recognized through JCPP the need to promote consistency and quality care. And this sort of draft care process for pharmacy is a work in process, I would say. But it's largely analogous to the care processes that exist today in nursing and in medicine, and really are something that we need to tease out and talk about and develop as a profession. Meanwhile, there are radical changes happening in payment, and in care processes. The move toward integrated care models is significant. It's rare that one talks about an accountable care organization, or ACO, without mentioning medical homes. And yet, they're different. You know, an ACO is really a financing model, and a medical home is a care model. In the context of medical homes, many people today are talking about medical neighborhoods and the notion that lots of people get involved in the medical home. And as Dr. Perman described last night, it's not necessarily always the physician who leads that team, depending on the application of the team and the necessary requirements. The news media is picking up on the notion that pharmacists have something to offer in the healthcare equation. Not just this article in Health Affairs from May 2010, where Marie Smith describes the role that pharmacists can play in medical homes, and this was widely read and broadly well received, but all the, JAMA, New England Journal, Circulation, Wall Street Journal, LA Times, New York Times have all had remarkable articles about the contributions that pharmacists can make in healthcare. And the types of contributions that we can make are in these key areas. These are just some representative services that pharmacists provide today in America. And You know, any one of them could be a career. Any one of them could be a specialty for pharmacists. But broadly, your students need to sort of understand these types of services. We've done a lot of work around, you know, what does it take to get new services implemented in a physician practice, for example, or in a medical home. And we had a medical home work group in our practice academy. And some of the key learnings that we got from that are that when a pharmacist sits down with a physician or group of physicians, they don't start with, you need an anticoagulation clinic. Instead, they say, what are your challenges? What are your workflow snags? What can we do to help you? And sort of open the door and get them talking about that in their context and in their terms. And really to start with the basics that the physicians understand that we have to contribute right away. Certainly drug information and patient education, they get. That's a no-brainer. But it really is a door opener to get us into other discussions with them about things that we have to offer. I think it's remarkable. I had a conversation with a senior exec with one of the national medical associations last month, and he reminded me that there's not a single medical school in America today that has a pharmacologist on their faculty teaching the things that we learn in pharmacy school. They don't get it anymore in medical training. They get it in their residencies, they get it in their experiential training, and what they get is far less deep than what we get and what we need to continue to provide to our students. So what are some of the competencies that we need to promote in emerging care models? Well, certainly we need to continue to teach and train the clinical expertise. But we need to teach, and Dr. Perman hit on this last night in an incredibly, just a remarkable presentation about the need for developing collaborative relationships and the ability for students to learn how to put a team together and how to construct it and build the workflow and build the relationships among the team members. Certainly communication skills are key, and we need to continue to do that. We teach patient counseling. We're doing a great job there, but there's more to it. Motivational interviewing is certainly important. Coaching, the ability to coach patients is certainly important. And becoming increasingly familiar and comfortable with being measured. The need for quality metrics is key. Additionally, medication access issues are critical. Health information technology. You know, many of you may not be aware that pharmacy is working together today better than I think we have, at least in my history, in 25 to 30 years of hanging around national organizations. I think we're doing a pretty good job today. And one key area where we're doing that is in health information technology. We put together a collaborative that involves about a dozen national and state pharmacy organizations, together with another dozen or so corporate partners, around health information technology to help get the pharmacists plugged into the electronic health record. And they've made major progress. We've published through that collaborative a roadmap for how pharmacists get plugged in. We've spent a lot of time with the Office of the National Coordinator for HIT within the federal government. And we've developed a set of SNOMED codes, codes that allow us to document and characterize what pharmacists have to offer in healthcare in ways that heretofore we've been unable to do. So we're making major progress, we're working together, and you should feel good about that and do what you can to help promote that with us. And then, you know, there is the big question about physical assessment skills and just how much we should focus on those. I think it's in some practices going to be essential, in others not so much. So it's certainly worth talking about what group of students get taught physical assessment skills. Is it all? Is it some? But I don't think it should be lost. I think it's an important element for certain areas of pharmacy practice. And then I just remind you that 2015 isn't that far off. And the whole notion of accountability is huge. And it's something that we haven't really figured out particularly well yet that we need to spend a lot of time on. When we step up in these teams and we accept accountability, just what does that mean? And teaching your students that and giving them the experience of knowing what it means to make a recommendation and understand that you got to be ready to take that to the bank. And it's got to be well researched, well thought out, and it takes more than just a one-off experience to throw a recommendation out there. You have to really think about it. So with that, I'll stop, and I guess we'll take questions later. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I'm very pleased to be with you today, and thank you to the organizing committee for inviting me to share some of my views. And congratulations, Vicki. I don't know what you said to Steve Gray to keep him at 10 minutes. I've never been able to do that. I arrived yesterday a little bit later, about 3:30, and I actually didn't get to check into my room until about 7:30 in the evening. So just so you know, when you go back to your rooms today, I did ask them to get my room cleaned up first, so yours are going to be later. They're going to give me that for the inconvenience yesterday. I want to give you just a little bit of perspective about where I come from and what sort of shapes my opinions. I am at Western University of Health Sciences. It's a graduate health sciences university just east of Los Angeles. Most of our students have annual passes to Disneyland, so when they finish an exam, they're straight down the freeway to Disneyland. 3,000 students, 300 faculty in 9 colleges, and this is a list of the colleges. I won't go through that, but it is fairly comprehensive, and based on our discussions yesterday, we also have a veterinary college, and we do incorporate veterinary medicine in our interprofessional education. We have, we have 9 different perspectives, but one focus, and our interprofessional courses, our core courses in professional education, really bring us all together. And the background, the questions that I want to address are current pharmacy graduates prepared to provide direct patient care? And if not, should this be an explicit outcome of pharmacy education? And having the perspective, I'm a facilitator for interprofessional education, and we have some 943 93 different groups that are meeting simultaneously with 93 facilitators teaching over 900 students all at the same time in our case-based interprofessional education. So I really have a vested interest in learning about our other health professions and what their scope of practice is. And so I'm going to be drawing from some of that experience in my comments today. And we have 2 different types of educational outcomes. One is a practice-ready outcome, and the other is a residency-ready outcome. And so our medical, we have a College of Osteopathic Medicine, and they are preparing graduates for residencies, as is podiatric medicine. So I'd like to just focus very briefly on dental medicine and veterinary medicine and just let us draw some comparisons. And you can see the scope of practice for dental medicine, and obviously it's maxillofacial area, oral cavity, so it's fairly localized, and some would argue, well, that's why it's a 4-year education, and they're able to go out and practice. But the truth is, graduates of dental medicine go out and put a sign on their door and say, I'm ready for patients. About a third of graduates go into a postgraduate training for specialization. And the educational outcomes statement says graduates possess the basic knowledge, skills, and values to practice dentistry independently at the time of graduation. And that just is almost identical to the statement. It is identical to the statement for pharmacy. We have the same educational outcomes. If we look at veterinary medicine, Theirs is actually a little bit more complex because they're doing prevention, diagnosis, treatment of disease, disorder and injury in animals, covering all animal species, both domesticated and wild. So that's a huge undertaking. At the end of 4 years, those graduates put a sign on the door and say, bring me your sick. And they're also very aware, as it was mentioned yesterday, of the importance of the integration and the crossover, the 200 plus zoonotic diseases that affect humans. And their educational outcomes, really the only difference in this statement, new graduates must have the basic scientific knowledge, skills, and values to provide entry-level health care independently at the time of graduation. And I like the fact that they put, this is entry-level health care. The expectation of a recent graduate is entry-level health care. And we might think about that. Now, I don't want you to read this, but this is what I could find about scope of practice of pharmacy. We have a problem in pharmacy, and I've searched a lot of different things about a concise statement that defines scope of practice for pharmacy. And if you go into Remington, for example, it'll give you like four or five different definitions of scope of practice based on a variety of different sources. So I think if we're selling our profession, we need to be very careful about what does scope of practice mean nationally, not statewide, but is there a national definition of scope of practice that we can use as our calling card? And our educational outcomes are identical to those in dentistry, with the only word here is to practice pharmacy instead of dentistry, independently at the time of graduation. And these items include the ability to design, implement, monitor, evaluate, and adjust pharmacy care plans that are patient-specific. This is direct patient care, if you ask me. So we have in guideline 12.1, we have a within that standard, one of the outcomes is that we are providing direct patient care on graduation. Some insights into perception. It was in 2006 and 2007 that both ACCP and ASHP came out with their statement, a recommendation for residencies for those that will be involved in direct patient care. And I have to, and we were talking over breakfast this morning, a lot of we are all influenced by our personal experiences, and even a lot of the literature at the time that was this justifying residencies for all was based on people's experience that, you know, I didn't feel confident when I graduated, we weren't given enough direct patient care responsibility, and a lot of things of that sort. And so there are perceptions from quite a bit earlier, and but this was all prior to full implementation of standards 2007. And things that have changed are improved preceptors. We have, you know, a new breed of preceptors that are out there. There's been evolution in the curriculum. We have authorization, medication therapy management authorization, which puts a higher standard and a higher requirement on our graduates. We're providing immunizations. We've shifted a lot of pharmacy, or a lot of our prerequisites have increased for pharmacy programs, and we've increased the amount of experiential education. And, you know, in many cases, it's 40% or more of our entire curriculum. So the world has changed around us, and we have to think, are those recommendations still appropriate? How do we build confidence and demonstrate competence? I think we need closer links between learning and application. Maybe thinking about the way we teach, more problem-based, have students involved in the discovery of during their learning process, hold the students continuously accountable for learning, and which would provide similar types of experiences as on-the-job training or quality residency programs or quality APPEs. If we took those learning concepts and put them more into our didactic curriculum, I think our students would develop a lot more confidence, and that builds lifelong learning skills as well. And shift the focus from instructor evaluation to student evaluation of learning. We hear a lot about students lack confidence. Well, if students are doing self-assessment of their learning throughout their educational process, when they finish, they know what they're competent in doing. They're capable of self-assessing that. So right now, we throw tons of information at them, and I think we intimidate them with the parade of specialists that are teaching them therapeutics, So I think that gets in our way a little bit. Does passing NAPLEX demonstrate competence in providing direct patient care? Probably not. And we probably want to have more emphasis focused on standard 12, which are more of the patient care educational outcomes are in there. And if we can measure those more effectively through NAPLEX, I think we would all feel a little bit better. Competencies required of a practice-ready pharmacist. You have background reading that there was the Council of Deans task force that worked on the future of educational outcomes for schools and colleges of pharmacy. And the things that have already been mentioned, perform physical assessment for MTM. Physical assessment is important. We're not doing enough of it in our programs. Promote wellness and lifestyle modification. And you can read these. These are in the background reading. And certainly work collaboratively in interprofessional setting. I did want to point out yesterday it was mentioned about some of the history of interprofessional education. Actually, the first Institute of Medicine report that was published back in, I think, 1974 was on interprofessional education. So even the Institute of Medicine launched with that as their initial subject. My position, we cannot rely on PGY1 residencies to create a pharmacy workforce that's needed to meet our current needs and demands in society. But what we can produce is a practice-ready pharmacist, someone that can put the sign on the door in whatever practice setting, and improve quality, and we can do that by improving the quality and expectations of APPEs, provide more responsibility-centered education, improve patient assessment skills, and document critical competencies. And some of that will be done through high-level simulations and higher standards and expectations for APPEs. Final thought, are we training drug therapy experts? I do not think we are. And that really should not be an expectation. Our graduates are entry-level healthcare providers and who are trained to improve patient safety and drug-related outcomes in any practice setting. I think any of our graduates can improve drug outcomes in any practice setting, and we have to define exactly what that skill set is, measure it, demonstrate the outcomes and the competencies associated with that. And then residency and specialization is going to take care of the rest. We have to learn to refer people to specialists, right? Thank you very much.
Well, good morning. My name is Lori Galdhuman, and I am from the Department of Veterans Affairs. I'd like to thank ACPE for including me today and Bill Zellmer, who coached me all the way through. This was the most challenging presentation I've done in a long time. So I invested this presentation and vetted it with the Residency Advisory Board that I have, who have members such as Dan Carmichael, Bill Jones, Ken Kellick, Margaret Kremko, John Alfaro. And it set up a firestorm of a discussion as to where we need to go and what needs to be changed in pharmacy education. So I'm going to give you a brief overview of the VA, what we're doing, and then I want to go into how we see changing pharmacy education to meet the demands that we have in the VA. The VA residency program trains about 20% of all pharmacists that come through a residency program. We have over 560 residents, and we're anticipating to have about 60 more in mental health in the upcoming year. So it is a huge aspect of how we seed our programs within VA and the profession, and that's our mission. But our vision is to have accessibility of a pharmacist to every veteran. And when you think about that statement, that opens up a whole new avenue of how many pharmacists we would need to have complete access to a pharmacist in everyday life and handling their problems. So one of the things that we've started with now in VA is the medical home, and what we have dubbed it as patient-aligned care team. So we call it the PAC model. And at first, pharmacists were not included, but as it moves along, pharmacists are being integrated more and more. And we have identified some skills that are required that we didn't necessarily think we would need going into this model. So some of the things that have come up over and over again in terms of the profession of pharmacy is, what is our professional vision? Where are we going and what are we looking for? I think we're very confused as a profession. My father is a civil engineer, and he said, you know, pharmacy is a lot like engineering. We have civil, electrical, mechanical, and divided we lose, but united we would stand. And he said, pharmacy is much like that. You have the retail network, you have the clinical side, you have academia, you have all these different approaches to pharmacy, but we don't all unite behind one effort. And I think that's very important for us as a profession to say, finally, we are clinical and we need to move forward and have the skills in the students to meet those demands. So committing to that is one of our first, developing a vision and committing to that is very important from our perspective to meet what the demand that we have. And then we have to look at what a student needs to look like. Maybe we ought to look at what the final product is and move backwards and say, what is the education we need to meet the demands that we have in direct care? And if we all commit to clinical, that's exactly where we need to go. You heard Walgreens doing a great job at implementing direct care with patients now. Retail network is moving that way. In VA, it's very easy to provide clinical services. We have scopes of practice, and we allow the pharmacist to independently practice and prescribe and manage patients. We do that there. I have to say, in VA, it's an ideal setting. We've made it easy for everybody. But if you go out to the private sector, where I've had practiced in the private sector, it's not so easy. They look at you like you have two horns on your head, and what are you doing here? You're questioning my therapy. We need to envelop all these practice sites and say, how do we train our students to do better and practice in all these different environments? One of the things we talked about is your student selection. I have a colleague who teaches both in medicine and pharmacy, and when he asks the medical students, you know, how many of you want to practice in direct care? They all raise their hand. How many of you want to assume the liability for what you prescribe? They all raise their hand. He goes to pharmacy and they say, how many of you want to practice in direct care? They raise their hand. How many of you want to assume the liability? Nobody raises their hand. So this is very important from the mentality that we have in selecting our students. Maybe we have to select different types of students into pharmacy, and maybe we have to select less and dedicate more time to those students. And I know it's an income for all the schools, but we need to take a step back and say, are the numbers that we're putting through pharmacy school what we need to move the profession forward? So one of the things that I wait for every year is the IBM report. And the IBM report looks at questions CEOs worldwide and says, what are the attributes that you need to succeed in today's market? Last year, it was that they had a vision and that they were creative and could move forward. This year, it was adaptability. We need to find people who have those qualities. And I'm going to show you something. When I say select a balanced team, there's a reason for it. Now, this is hard to read, but you have it in your papers. Let me see here if I can. What's that? You have it, right? There's a lot of discussion what's going on up there. Oh, it's hard to read stuff. Okay. So let me share with you what this is. I set this up, and what I use with all the residents and with a lot of our preceptors is something called HBDI. It's something that Ned Herman was asked to set up under Jack Welch in GE. And what Jack Welch asked him to do is set up a program by which new employees coming into the system could be placed in a team where their strengths would best be used. And when you look at healthcare and the medical whole model, this was designed to say, okay, what are the thinking styles? And Donna Herman created this program that identified thinking styles of people. So it's like Myers-Briggs or something like this. I find it very, very easy to use and applicable to most of the residents, and they retain it. So We looked at this from the medical home model, and where is this? Here, let me try this. Okay, can you see this little red dot? If there are those in the back, you guys are very serious today, too, by the way. I was watching. It's a very quiet group, very serious. All right, so if you, this little red dot, if you can see it, this side over here is pharmacy. And I've had this discussion with many of you, that pharmacists naturally gravitate to this side of the thinking preference, and this is left-sided thinking. So here you have the outcomes performance measures. It's very data-driven, evidence-based. And here, down here, where is this little dot? Okay. But what has this one? I am dotless. All right, so the green section there is how you implement something. And pharmacists are left-sided thinkers, and they naturally gravitate that way. And when you look at medicine, the yellow side that says prevention is visionary. And they're into, medicine is primarily outcomes-based and visionary. You look at nurses, and that's on the bottom, and they're primarily the communicators, the red, service and feedback, and best practices they implement. So when you have a balanced team of nurses, physicians, and pharmacists, you have better outcomes with your patients, and it makes sense. This is thousands of profiles of different professionals, thousands that make up this chart. And we looked at this because when you look at the profession and how we think, you're trying to create a vision, and we have to move people forward. Think about it when you were a child. You were very different than you are now. You had a lot of creative ideas. You were into a lot of different things, maybe good, maybe not so good. But you had different ideas than what you have now. When you go to school, they say, you need to learn this and this. And then you come out and you're a professional and you're here. What we need is to foster creativity and adaptability in our pharmacists and our pharmacy students. We need to foster the communication side and the visionary side. And we can only do that by selecting people that have these gifts and change who we accept into pharmacy school. So some of the student skills that we identified that are required for taking care of patients, they commonly don't know their own limitations. So teaching them is very important as to what that is. We strongly believe that introducing them to experiential training earlier, reducing the didactic learning by a year, and incorporating more of these experiential learning sites with actual patient care in interprofessional learning is extremely important. I can tell you, I've had students come to me, and I do take residents and I had to take students in central office and VA central office. But the students were coming to me on their 6 months of advanced pharmacy practice. And when I'd asked what they wanted to learn, they said, can you teach me how to write a note? Can you teach me how to assess a patient? I'm in an administrative type setting and I'm making up cases. I have colleagues of mine that are hypertensive. I said, come in here and sit and tell them your story. This is not for me to be doing. This is for their learning, their experiential learning, to be acquiring this and having this available to these students. I have students that come into D.C. that lose their rotations, and they have to find rotations in D.C. I think we're expecting too much of students. This needs to be mapped out. And I can tell you I've had other slides here that I've removed because they were removed. But when I did a poll of our pharmacy residents this year, half of them responded to the survey. And we said, what is your preferred practice? 90% of them said ambulatory care. Why? Because we're coaching them that way. We need people in high-use, high-risk areas like ICU, emergency rooms, transplant. We need those clinicians, but we're not training them. And I'm the first to say, VA is great in ambulatory care, and we have to begin to open their eyes to other areas. I had a resident work with me this year who was fantastic. But his skills, if you remember that wheel, were more towards the visionary side. And he said, I'll be honest, I've applied to medical school. Pharmacy is just too boring. And I said, what do you mean it's too boring? Have you been in ICU? Have you been in emergency? He goes, no, I didn't have rotations that way. That's wrong. We are not expanding their horizons and getting them involved in teams that we need them in. And we critically need them in those areas. And it's not just ambulatory care. So these are things we need to think about and how we're going to build this into our students and build that creativity and that adaptability into them. So assessing and managing patient care is just unnatural. We need to do that. We need to do that early, and we need to have the preceptors there to do that. You know, one of the things that I don't know that we do well is modeling. For the good, the bad, and the ugly, I don't know that we model problems with our students. So I have residents that come to the VA central office, and I'm going to be honest, things get said, and I'm surprised myself that they get said. They go into briefings with the secretary, the undersecretary, and some things get said, and you're like, whew, all right, so we have to backtrack and ask them how they would have handled the situation differently and take them through the case as to how we could have done it better and had better outcomes. And modeling is very important. All of us sitting in this room have years of experience and know how to get in and out of situations, how to communicate well and do it so that we can negotiate something and get what we want and do it for the benefit of the patient. We need to be able to teach that to people. It's not so much the art of teaching, it's sharing life experiences and helping them through the skill sets and how to think through things, critical thinking skills, sharing that with people, with the students. Formulating medication plans, it's a very basic minimum that needs to be done early in their education. We have residents coming to us that have a difficult time saying, this is how I would look at it. And I'm thinking, this should have been done in their APPE, and they're not getting that. So residents come to us from every level of practice, and we have to, I always tell our RPDs, you start at ground zero and you work your way up, and you make sure that they can handle one patient well. If they can handle one, they can handle two, and we go from there. So it's very important that they're able to do some basic minimums. Identifying outcomes to med use is extremely important to us. There's a whole process that we have put in place. I was fortunate to work with Jan Carmichael and Sharon Castle and myself. We created a workload documentation system in VA. We're now linking outcomes of what our pharmacists do in certain performance measures. Residents are linked to that as well. So we'll be looking at what residents contribute to overall health care in the VA system, and identifying these outcomes and what we need to achieve is important. Initiate, modify, and monitor med use is extremely important, as well as leading. And I'm going to get more into leading if I have time, because it's one of my favorite things to talk about. Oh, okay. She's telling me I have time, which is dangerous for you.
We're at time.
Oh.
We're at time.
Okay, I'm going to speed through the next set of slides. If you have questions, you can you can ask me. All right, some of the basic skills that we've identified for integration into our PAC teams are physical assessments, mini mental health. We get this asked all the time for mental health. Advanced cardiac life support. Patient safety initiatives. Research design. We have set up a system in VA where we teach residents how to assess research design, if it's relative, if it's a good research design, how to understand the research and how to apply it to their practice. The one thing that residents continually ask us for is how to implement clinical service and the business aspects of it. We work with them on that as well. The leadership skills, we'll talk about some other time. Collaborative training programs. With the Office of Academic Affiliation, who funds our residency programs, everything is moving to interprofessional learning programs. So we are now piloting several different centers of excellence, and the mental health program will also be interprofessional, where I have included pharmacists for that particular project. We need a standardized approach to patient care. We have to speak the same language as physicians and nurses. So if we don't have that, we're at a deficit. We need to change the curriculum of pharmacy education, as I mentioned earlier. We need to hopefully reduce the didactics, put them into clinical practice much earlier with exposure to patients. The workload and outcomes documentation, as I mentioned, we're doing that in VA. And the one important thing that we don't do that every other profession does is giving us permission to teach, to coach, to research, and to publish. We need time in our functional statements to say that, yes, I do have a half a day to do this. And help hopefully change the way we're able to approach the education of our students. The last thing I want to say is if we're in it for the long term, we need to be available 24/7. Most of us don't want to hear that. But if we're offering services, we need to be available to physicians and nurses and patients on a continual basis. And with that, I'm going to leave this because we're out of time. But if you have any questions, please feel free to contact me. You've been very patient as I went over. Thank you very much.
I know I have the hardest job at this conference, which is to stop speakers from presenting what I know is of interest to each and every one of us. But I'm hopeful that in our facilitated discussion that we're going to have, in addition to some of the discussion we're going to have this afternoon at the work groups, that really take everything we've learned, what Donna presented, what all of our speakers have presented, what you've been reading, and take it in to collectively brainstorm how these expectations, current and future, for practicing pharmacists should shape the accreditation standards. But I did have, after having read all of the our panelists' presentations, I did have some questions that I thought might be able to get some engaged discussion and debate going up here, because that can be fun as we compare and contrast different viewpoints about some of the things we heard. And so I'm going to try to get a question to each and every person. But and again, I'll direct a question to an individual, but then certainly welcome a comment or two from others as they would like to weigh in. But I'm going to start with Dan. Steve noted in his full remarks, and actually we've heard from Tom and Dr. Perman as well, but at Kaiser, that I'm going to quote here, the focus and culture is about teamwork for providing high quality and affordable health care. Traditional turf wars over scope of practice are virtually not part of the culture. So my question to you is, how can pharmacy education better promote that professional disposition? Can we establish educational homes, if you will, that are akin to medical homes so that all graduates are truly prepared to enter into this collaborative, team-based practice model? What do you think?
Well, I think that the educational models, I think interprofessional education is really the direction we need to go. When students begin even in their first year in their professional programs and they're starting to interact with other students of other professions, they haven't had time to develop their personal identity and their professional identity to such a point that there's biases and there's so you're getting these students very green, and they're learning together, and they're experiencing and learning from, with, and about each other very early on in their curriculum. So before all the opinions are formed, and I think that's been we're seeing that's been a real advantage. In fact, many of our applicants that come to our program now are coming because of interprofessional education, not for pharmacy, but for medicine and for the other disciplines as well. So the students want to work together, as Dr. Perman said, follow the students, let them take the lead, and they'll show you, and this is really what they want.
Excellent. Other comments on this issue? Okay, well then let me ask those in a position to hire, kind of playing off what Dan had talked about in his presentation, those that are in a position to hire pharmacists, would you hire a new pharmacy graduate without a residency? And if not, what would academic pharmacy need to do differently to change your mind? And I'm going to ask Nimish to start us off.
So the short answer is yes. It depends on the setting. So we have not only a community setting, but we also have worksite, specialty, centers of excellence, HIV centers of excellence. In those particular settings, whether it's in a community-based or a corporate-based pharmacy practice, yes, we will require a certain type of extra requirements and education. However, for the community setting, yeah, we may hire and we will hire pharmacists that don't have residencies. But the key here isn't so much the clinical aspect. Again, as I said earlier, you're preparing great pharmacists to do the clinical aspects. Where the gap is are they ready to lead a team? We talked a lot about team the last 2 days. Even in the new model, they practice pharmacy from afar. They're not standing next to a technician. They're not standing next to a cashier. They're not standing next to a nurse practitioner. They're managing from afar. And do they have those qualities to allow them to lead through technology, through their skill set of providing direction, and then holding the expectations to that direction? I think those are the qualities that we need to continue to enforce in the academic world, as well as when they come into the real world, is how do we help them understand how to lead? And we're not going to be able to get to the team-based collaborative approach if they don't know how to lead. The issue isn't the clinical aspect. The issue is, how do they lead?
Excellent. Steve, do you have a comment you want
to? Yeah, I think he's right on. It depends on the situation. In many instances, with what the job is going to be, and you have to fill a job right now, and certainly there aren't enough resident graduates to fill every outpatient dispensing position. But the direction we're moving in is to try, as Walgreens is trying to do, is to make every pharmacist practice to the full extent of their education and their learning and their experience. And one of the things we find with the residencies, with the clinical accredited residency graduates, is, yes, they get more in-depth clinical training. Yes, they learn about systems. Yes, they learn about a lot of different things during their residencies. But what we find is most encouraging is they learn a greater sense of responsibility, a greater sense of commitment to the care. And that's been mentioned several times. You know, when you're a student, you're really not licensed. You're really not internalizing the ultimate responsibility. That's the job of your preceptor or whoever it is. But when you're a resident, you're licensed, and we expect them to take that responsibility and to learn that. And it's not a 9-to-5 job, as Lori was mentioning. It's a 24/7 job, and to be ultimate responsible. So we're moving in the direction of, we want every outpatient dispensing pharmacy to hold a responsibility for the outcome of that prescription they're dispensing. And we haven't gotten there yet, but we're moving in that direction. And so if we can get that sense of responsibility and commitment without them going through a residency, then yes, I think that's something we would definitely continue to hire many pharmacists who don't have a residency. But that's now what we're looking for the most.
Yeah, Lori.
PA will hire somebody out of school for dispensing services. However, they will require a residency to do any of the clinical work that we have, and then they will be given a scope of practice and go through peer review. So that is the way we have set it up, and we just had new qual standards developed. However, we do have some non-traditional residency programs in VA that are growing. What this means is we can take pharmacists who are dispensing and allow them to work as a pharmacist and half the year work as a resident over a 2-year period. This has been extremely successful for us, and it has improved the workforce and their capabilities to handle direct patient care. So we are working with the dispensing pharmacists to ensure that they have a higher level of skill sets through this non-traditional program.
Great. I'm going to highlight some things that several people brought up, and that's leadership and advocacy. I know that was a theme that resonated through so many of the presentations, both spoken and what's in the notebook and your full presentation. So I guess my question to those that would like to answer it is ACPE doing enough to emphasize in the standards the development of these leadership characteristics and the ability to advocate for the profession and for the patients to advance practice in the way you see it needs to be advanced in the future? And I'll throw that open. Maybe Steve, you could start, and Tom, I know you haven't had a chance to speak yet, too.
Thank you. You know, I struggled with that question because the question was, is ACPE doing enough? I'm a strong believer in advocacy, and I think advocacy covers an entire spectrum that we often don't think about. We often think of advocacy as advocacy with the legislature, the Board of Pharmacy, et cetera. But advocacy starts at the very front counter, advocating that with that patient that this is the medication for you, and this is what you need to stick to. You know, our learnings are that many of the physicians don't want pharmacists to counsel patients, because they start off by warning them of all the bad things that are going to happen. And it actually works against adherence, and it works against the outcomes where the physician or the other prescriber has made the benefit-risk decision. And so I don't think that whether it's ACPE's job or whatever, I think that it's very important for all the pharmacists, because they have that direct patient care contact, to first of all start with a sense and an ability and a skill set to advocate for better care, for better health lifestyles, for advocate for all the things that mean direct patient care, and then grow that to advocate with managers, with administrators, with health insurance commissioners, with NGOs, non-government organizations, and eventually the government or whatever, to how to advocate. And, you know, maybe it's basically teaching them basic sales training. You know, maybe it's something that they should get out of a pre-pharmacy MBA. You know, you start with a concept, first you sell yourself, then you sell your organization, your profession, and then you sell the product or the service or the idea that you're going through. And with that kind of really skill set and understanding, advocacy becomes just a natural flow of what you do in everyday practice.
Tom? I think ACPE does a fair job of promoting leadership development in pharmacy curriculum, but I don't think it's their job only to do that, at least not within that curriculum. You know, many of us learned leadership in high school or in grade school or in our postgraduate jobs where we were thrust into situations where we had to learn things. So I think we have to reach back into the educational system and sort of think about the types of students who we bring into pharmacy school. And we have to reach forward through continuing professional development to continue to promote lifelong learning and leadership development within that. This is a partnership for life. This is a career. This is not just a four-year exposure to leadership training. And we can't expect colleges to do it all in that four-year period.
Continuing what Tom said, I'm cautioned that we can't put everything back into the standards or ask the standards to address every issue or challenge that the profession faces. One of the speakers said we have to come up with a unified mission, a unified definition of pharmacy practice, a unified definition of what a pharmacist is and what a patient needs, and work backwards. We have to establish those parameters, and then we have to decide what the standards should measure and need to measure in order to provide the legal basis of a quality education, as well as what the profession and the colleges and the other stakeholders say, this is what a graduate of this program needs to be, and the standards need to check that. But if we start looking at advocacy and leadership and try to ask the standards to address all those concerns to the fullest extent, we're going to create a situation where ACP and the standards are going to fail and not deliver the product that we need to deliver.
Amen.
One comment on that, and I agree with all of my colleagues up here. I don't know if everybody knows, but earlier this year, MSN actually rated the top 10 professions for introverts. Guess what number two was? Right behind a software engineer was a pharmacist.
Yeah.
So the question really becomes, and as you can see, all of us are very much introverted, but the really question is are we bringing in the right students into our profession? And I agree with you, leadership does start at an earlier time than simply going into pharmacy school. So the question that we should be asking ourselves is, what are our basic qualifications to get into pharmacy school, and who are we bringing in so subsequently when they do become pharmacists, they already have some of those leadership skills that we're looking for? To have a pharmacist be an introvert in this world and in the healthcare arena should be embarrassing for all of us that's even stated.
You know, I agree with that. Leadership is something that I focus on with all our residents, and I think that there are some things we could do differently. Where you have advanced professional experiences, why not set some standards for those and ask the sites that are training your students to meet some of the standards set in terms of leadership and what needs to be done. Why let them go willy-nilly and learn whatever they learn? They need to have a set standard as to, if they go to ICU, they need to learn certain basic concepts in ICU. And I contend that we need to teach them skill sets. If you teach them strong skill sets, they'll be able to handle pediatrics, geriatrics, and ICU. We need that repetition, and we need to teach those clinical skills over and over. And also, the extent that we have them in these experiential learning sessions, most times it's 4 to 6 weeks, and it's too short. They just get familiar with the computer system. They get to know some of the docs, and boom, they're gone. We need to extend that so that they really get entrenched in that, apply the skills that they have, and maybe repeat it. So they come back and they're winners. Maybe they're good the first time around, but maybe they're great the second time. And I think we need to start looking at that. And maybe the standards need to be imposed in those experiential training sites. And maybe you have to start paying for them, because you're going to pick them, and that's how your students are going to learn. And maybe we ought to compete those sites. So there's any number of ways we can do it and do it better than we've done in the past. And I think leadership is just one aspect, as they said, and it's a continuum. But we need to start looking at how we do those experiential trainings and do it to the best we can for the profession.
And perhaps try to break the self-fulfilling prophecy that you talked about in terms of what pharmacists are and where they were on your chart. Because the people making decisions about who the future pharmacists are data and evidence-based, and so they're looking to data to pick the best candidates, which are GPAs and other measures. And some colleges that don't even have interviews for students, I question how you can decide then whether or not that student is going to be a good pharmacist or how that student should be accepted in that program.
It's required now.
Shout-out to all those introverts in the world. I feel like somebody's got to stand up for them. I shudder to think about a world that's all extroverts. And
you mean like this conference?
We really undervalue our introverts. And this weekend I watched an incredibly bright young lady lead a committee discussion. This is an introvert, and she led by active listening and did a phenomenal job. And I think it would be dangerous if we picked all extroverts for our pharmacy school.
I happen to agree with you. But if we pick balanced teams with strengths in all those different aspects and quadrants, we'll have a much better profession, because we will have those that are the visionaries, we'll have those that are the communicators, and those that actually are the thinkers and the left-sided thinkers, and we will do much better as a profession.
So those are the challenges, I think, in terms of getting the right people in, setting the right curriculum. And as I listen to this, I know there have been discussions across the country about should a baccalaureate degree be required? Do we have enough time in the curriculum to develop the scientific foundation, as well as to provide in-depth clinical education, both at the IPP and APPE level? And I guess I would ask all of you to reflect, and I think you've hit on some of this as you've gone, but maybe crystallize what needs to give in the pharmacy curriculum in order to accomplish your vision for educating students that come out with those essential competencies for contemporary practice as well as for the practice in the immediate future. We've just got a few minutes, and I would love to hear everybody's response. Maybe could we start with Carmen and just work our way down the line?
I really don't know how to answer that question. I think that's the purpose of part of this meeting, so I defer more to the academics, but say to focus more on what the practice is and what the pharmacists need to deliver for patient care, and then build from there, and maybe not provide some of the additional training in primary care or some of those expanded areas until we've mastered some of those primary pharmacist responsibilities.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same place. As I'd mentioned earlier, I think there are things that we need to add, but not necessarily add them to the pharmacy school curriculum, add them before they get to pharmacy school. So I'm one of those that believes that a bachelor's degree or an equivalent in terms of all the identified. I'm not necessarily, someone once said you can get a degree or you can get an education, but you can't get both. So I'm not necessarily saying that a bachelor's degree is the answer, but there are certain topics that need to come before pharmacy school. I'm also one, as I mentioned, to say that I don't know that the current way we teach and the expectations we place on students are stringent enough. Way back in the 70s, when I was working alongside teams of medical students, we worked 72 hours on, 24 hours off. The students did, as well as the residents and so forth. And you talk about they gained from the few of us that did that out of a class of 120 a sense of appreciation that pharmacists are willing to make that commitment also. And I don't think we expect enough. And I go back to, should there be allowed a 3-year school? Should it be, year-round training? Should it be that there are allowed to work? Because, can you really work and hold down a 20 or a 40-hour job and go to pharmacy school at the same time. I don't think those are no longer the reality that we're facing in terms of what pharmacists need to know to get that practice-ready PharmD, let alone advance as leaders in the healthcare professions.
I would agree with my colleagues, but I would ask how, one of the biggest challenges is education is not a one-stop and you're done. It needs to be lifelong. I had a great conversation with Michael Diamond yesterday, and I waited 15 years before I got my MBA. And I had a different appreciation for that MBA versus a brand new pharmacy student that came out with both of those degrees. So the question and the challenge that I certainly, as part of the challenge, is how do we extend a pharmacy student's education beyond graduation? So, do we have some type of a program that gives them an automatic acceptance into, let's say, an MBA program or a Master's of Public Health 5-6 years after they graduate? So they come in with experience, and they have a better appreciation for the education that they're going to receive. A little different take than simply saying, graduate, get your license, and make sure you do your CEs. This is lifelong learning that we can continue to define, refine, and give them better skills as they go on through their career. Just something that we may want to think about as we start to develop what this curriculum needs to look like.
I'm going to ask the last three speakers if they could crystallize. I hate to cut you short, but our time is just about up. So, but please, no, I'd like to hear what you have to say if you could crystallize your thoughts.
The question, as I heard it, was what's the give?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's more selectivity on the front end to look for leaders, communicators, and team players coming into pharmacy schools, and to echo what Nimesh said on the back end to promote lifelong learning, and this is a real partnership for life with the colleges of pharmacy. When I left my pharmacy school, it shouldn't have been the end of the relationship. That relationship should continue.
Thank you.
I'll specifically address the question by, I think that a lot of our curriculum is therapeutics and therapeutic related, and we parade lots of specialists in front of those students, and we teach so much depth and detail in various specialties, and I think that once we define the scope of practice more clearly, and we say these are the competencies we want of our graduating students, then we need to reinforce to each person that is standing in front of those students, from your specialty, what are the skill sets and knowledge that's necessary that you can have a positive impact on this patient population? Not that you have to know what I know about it. So I think we could peel off some of the depth that we're teaching if we could focus on what are the deliverables on graduation.
Excellent. Last word, Lori.
I agree with what he has mentioned. I think that we could take a year off of the didactics and begin to put them in clinical settings and further develop their critical thinking skills and their clinical skills and how to formulate a medication plan, which is critical for them as a life learner to move forward and begin to then lead a team to negotiate those medication plans into patient outcomes for the healthcare system. It's all related, and I think less didactics, more integration, more interprofessional training would be the key.
This is just, session has exceeded my wildest expectations. The panelists have been outstanding. I could have listened to you all for the rest of the conference. It's been terrific, and I would ask everybody to join me in thanking them for their outstanding presentation.
I didn't fall off.
We are going to take a half-hour break, and I would ask everybody to please be back in your seats at 10:45 so that we can be prompt in hearing Dr. Lucinda Main present her keynote. Thank you.